fire. The scramble outside and onto the street was completed without serious injury. The last person out was Marco, who ducked low to avoid the stampede while searching for his navy blue Silvio bag. As always, he had hung its strap over the back of his chair, with the bag resting so close to his body he could usually feel it. It had disappeared in the melee. The Italians stood in the street and stared in disbelief at the cafe. Their lunch was in there, half-eaten and now being ruined. Finally, a thin, light puff of smoke emerged and made its way through the door and into the air. A waiter could be seen running by the front tables with a fire extinguisher. Then some more smoke, but not much. "I lost my bag," Marco said to Luigi as they watched and waited.
"The blue one."
"How many bags do I carry around, Luigi?"
"Yes, the blue one."
He already had suspicions that the bag had been snatched. A small fire truck with an enormous siren arrived, slid to a stop, and kept wailing as the firemen raced inside. Minutes passed, and the Italians began to drift away. The decisive ones left to find lunch elsewhere while there was still time. The others just kept gawking at this horrible injustice. The siren was finally neutralized. Evidently the fire was, too, and without the need for water being sprayed all over the restaurant. After an hour of discussion and debate, and very little firefighting, the situation was under control.
"Something in the restroom,"
a waiter yelled to one of his friends, one of the few remaining weakened and unfed patrons. The lights were back on. They allowed them back inside to get their coats. Some who'd left in search of other meals were returning to get their things. Luigi became very helpful in the hunt for Marco's bag. He discussed the situation with the head waiter, and before long half the staff was scouring the restaurant. Among the excited chatter, Marco heard a waiter say something about a smoke bomb. The bag was gone, and Marco knew it. They had a panino and a beer at a sidewalk cafe under the sun where they could watch pretty girls stroll by. Marco was preoccupied with the theft, but he worked hard to appear unconcerned.
"Sorry about the bag," Luigi said at one point.
"No big deal.
I'll get you another cell phone."
"Thanks.
What else did you lose?"
"Nothing, just some maps of the city, some aspirin, a few euros."
In a hotel room a few blocks away, Zellman and Crater had the bag on the bed, its contents neatly arranged. Other than the Ankyo smartphone, there were two maps of Bologna, both well-marked and well-used, but revealing little. Four $100 bills, the cell phone Luigi had loaned him, a bottle of aspirin, and the owner's manual for the Ankyo. Zellman, the more agile computer whiz of the two, plugged the smartphone into an internet access jack and was soon fiddling with the menu. "This is good stuff," he was saying, quite impressed with Marco's gadget. "The absolute latest toy on the market." Not surprisingly, he was stopped by the password. They would have to dissect it at Langley. With his laptop, he emailed a message to Julia Javier, passing along the serial number and other information. Within 2 hours of the theft, a CIA agent was sitting in the parking lot outside Chatter in suburban Alexandria, waiting for the store to open. Chapter 26. From a distance he watched her shuffle along gamely, bravely with her cane, down the sidewalk beside Via Manzoni. He followed, and was soon 50 feet away. Today she wore brown suede boots, no doubt for the support. The boots had low heels. Flat shoes would have been more comfortable, but then she was Italian, and fashion always took priority. The light brown skirt stopped at her knees. She was wearing a tight wool sweater, bright red in color, and it was the first time he'd seen her when she wasn't bundled up for cold weather. No overcoat to hide her really nice figure. She was walking cautiously and limping slightly, but with a determination that gave him heart. It was just coffee at Nino's for an hour or two of Italian, and it was all for him. And the money. For a moment he thought about her money. Whatever the dire situation with her poor husband and her seasonal work as a tour guide,
She managed to dress stylishly and live in a beautifully decorated apartment. Giovanni had been a professor. Perhaps he had saved carefully over the years, and now his illness was straining their budget. Whatever. Marco had his own problems. He'd just lost $400 in cash and his only lifeline to the outside world. People who weren't supposed to know his whereabouts now knew his exact address. 9 hours earlier, he'd heard his real name used on Via Fandazza. He slowed and allowed her to enter Nino's, where she was again greeted like a beloved member of the family by Nino's boys. Then he circled the block to give them time to get her situated, to fuss over her, bring her coffee, chat for a moment, and catch up on the neighborhood gossip. 10 minutes after she arrived, he walked through the door and got bear-hugged by Nino's youngest son. A friend of Francesca's was a friend for life. Her moods changed so much that Marco did not know what to expect. He was still touched by the warmth of yesterday, but he knew that the indifference could return today. When she smiled and grabbed his hand and started all the cheek-pecking, he knew instantly the lesson would be the highlight of a rotten day. When they were finally alone, he asked about her husband. Things had not changed. "It's only a matter of days," she said with a stiff lip, as if she had already accepted death and was ready for the grieving. He asked about her mother, Signora Altanelli, and got a full report. She was baking a pear torta, one of Giovanni's favorites, just in case he got a whiff of it from the kitchen. "And how was your day?" she asked. It would be impossible to fictionalize a worse set of occurrences. From the shock of hearing his real name barked through the darkness to being the victim of a carefully staged theft, he couldn't imagine a worse day. "A little excitement during lunch," he said. "Tell me about it." He described his hike up to San Luca, to the spot where she fell, her bench, the views, the canceled session with Ermano, lunch with Luigi, the fire and the loss of his bag. She had not noticed the absence of it until he told the story. "There's so little crime in Bologna," she said, half apologetic. "I know Café Atene. It's not a place for thieves." These were probably not Italians, he wanted to say, but managed to nod gravely as if to say, "Yes, yes, what's the world coming to?" When the small talk was over, she switched gears like a stern professor and said she was in the mood to tackle some verbs. He said he was not, but his moods were unimportant. She drilled him on the future tense of abitare, to live, and vedere, to see. Then she made him weave both verbs in all tenses into 100 random sentences. Far from being distracted, she pounced on any wayward accent. A grammatical mistake prompted a quick reprimand, as if he had just insulted the entire country. She had spent the day penned up in her apartment with a dying husband and a busy mother. The lesson was her only chance to release some energy. Marco, however, was exhausted. The stress of the day was taking its toll, but Francesca's high-octane demands took his mind off his fatigue and confusion. 1 hour passed quickly. They recharged with more coffee, and she launched into the murky and difficult world of the subjunctive, present, imperfect, and past perfect. Finally, he began to founder. She tried to prop him up with reassurances that the subjunctive sinks a lot of students, but he was tired and ready to sink. He surrendered after 2 hours, thoroughly drained and in need of another long walk. It took 15 minutes to say goodbye to Nino's boys. He happily escorted her back to her apartment. They hugged and pecked cheeks and promised to study tomorrow. If he walked as directly as possible, his apartment was 25 minutes away, but he had not walked directly to any place in more than a month. He began to wander. At 4 p.m., 8 of the Kidan were on Via Fondazza at various points, one drinking coffee at a sidewalk cafe, 3 strolling aimlessly a block apart, 1 cruising back and forth on a scooter, and 1 looking out a window from the 3rd floor. Half a mile away outside the central city on the 2nd floor, above a flower shop owned by an elderly Jew, the 4 other members of the Kidan were playing cards and waiting nervously. One,
Ari was one of the top English intellectuals.